Going Linux, episode 123, Computer America, number 33. I'm Larry Bushy, the host of Going Linux.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Going Linux is an internet audio program, a podcast, for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows, or just thinking about going Linux, this audio program will provide you with practical, day-to-day advice on how to use your Linux computer. This is my 33rd appearance on the Computer America radio show from December 21st, 2010.
Computer America.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computer. It's Tuesday, the 21st of December, 2010. And I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
I'm your co-host, Kerry Holzman.
And welcome into a Tuesday edition of the show. I understand you had a good program. You had someone cancel on you last minute. It was last night, right?
It was a miscommunication, yeah.
Okay, but you're rescheduling them?
Yeah, they're good folks. It's over at TeamViewer. They're having to call in from Germany and things. They just got a new release, version 6. And so when I initially invited them on, they wanted to put it off until December to make their announcement of version 6. And then when the dates came around for December, they initially agreed to it. And then they got busy for something else came up, and they just felt that it would be better if we did it after the new year. So they'll be on. They'll be on, and okay. They'll be here to talk about the latest version 6 of TeamViewer and the features and enhancements that it adds from version 5.
There you go. All right. Well, obviously you're going to reschedule that, and I think this is the third Tuesday of the month. And the subject, of course, is the Linux operating system. It's a very popular operating system, and so on every third Tuesday of the month, we devote the entire show to Linux in order to answer questions about Linux. And if you have a Linux question, tonight's the night for you to give us a call. Joining us is our Linux expert, Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. Hey, Larry, welcome back into Computer America. How are you tonight?
Thanks very much. I'm doing very well.
Yeah.
A little rainy and wet here in California, but other than that, I'm doing well.
Rainy and wet, but other than that's fine. Yeah.
Where in California are you?
In Southern California, in Orange County, near Disneyland.
So, oh, okay, yeah, my mom lived in Huntington Beach there. We've got the rain, too, here in Phoenix. So a little drizzle off and on. They say it's supposed to be really rain tomorrow. But, you know, this is as close as we get to snow for the holidays. It certainly helped the situation. But, again, you got to learn how to drive. Just like with a computer, you can't just rely on that PC security software to protect you from yourself. None of this stuff, just as a car, can't protect you 100% from getting hurt or possibly killed in a car accident. PC security software. Even if you use Linux, you still have to be a smart driver. You still have to make wise decisions when it comes to what you do on the internet.
I was wondering how we were going to bring this back around to Linux. So thank you.
But it's true. It's true.
I mean, it is true.
Even with Linux. You know, we were talking there's a business group, a Yahoo business group, computer business group, and someone was asking about consumer firewalls and why people aren't using them anymore, and, you know, things like Zone Alarm and such. And the bottom line was that type of attack really doesn't happen anymore. It's pretty rare, certainly not for the consumer space, but things like VNC is going to go through a port that the router's already allowing anyway, if that's where the attack's going to come from, or with Adobe Reader or Flash. Again, the port's already open on the router, so the firewall isn't going to block that traffic or dangerous hack. And even in Linux, when people say, well, yeah, okay, there's no viruses for Linux, but they can still send you an email and say your Chase bank account has been suspended. Please click here to re-enable your account. And then when you do, you give in all of your account information, yada, 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 and your operating system at that point becomes irrelevant.
Right. Antivirus and the best protection in the world is not going to help you if you open an email from somebody, click on a link that takes you to a site where you download something that is going to take over your email or worse.
It could poison your DNS.
Right.
It could But I mean, even just clicking on a link, taking you to a site that looks like it's the right site, and you wouldn't know it's not the right site.
And filling out your bank account number, and confirming your password, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and Linux is just as vulnerable.
Sure.
So we don't want anybody to have their identity stolen this holiday season. We're all in a hurry, and we're trying to do things quick, maybe not paying very close attention to things. So just take a step back, take a deep breath, and we're going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk about the benefits of the Linux operating system when we return, and your phone calls at 866-606-8255. More Computer America, all Linux for both hours when we return.
It's 21 minutes after the hour here on the Computer America Show. It is our All Linux program. If you want to get in touch with us, it's really simple. We offer three easy ways to do it. Of course, the easiest is picking up the telephone and giving us a call. It's toll-free. The number is 866-606-TALK. That's 866-606-8255. That number will get you on, and it will get you through. We have a special email inbox set up when we're live and on the air, and it is live, L-I-V-E, at computeramerica.com. Send us an email if you don't want to go on the air, but you still want a question answered. It's a great way for you to do it. You can also join us in our live interactive add-on chat room. How you do that is you go over to our homepage at computeramerica.com. On the left-hand side there, you'll see it says chat with us. There's a place for you to put in a username. That's the name you'll be known by when you go in there. Click the login button beneath it, and your Java-enabled browser, be it on a Windows machine, Macintosh, Linux, Vista, Windows 7, Snow Leopard, they all work, will move you into the Computer America chat room. There's a place there for you to put in a password. You can ignore that. Leave it blank. You don't need it. The password is only there if you want to reserve the username that you create so no one else could ever use it again, because when they try to use it, it'll ask for a password. But if you leave it blank, just put in any username, and you'll be able to go in for that session. It is All Linux. Larry Bushy is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast, and he is with us here for both hours to talk about Linux. And I know, Carrie, you were talking to Larry just before we broke, and I can't remember if you had a particular
I just wanted to – yeah, well, we're going to talk – obviously, we're talking all about Linux tonight for both hours, and I just wanted to reiterate – that, well, there aren't the virus threats that are available for Linux. There are other threats that don't, just driving a Volvo doesn't guarantee you're not going to get injured or killed in a car accident, and having Linux doesn't mean you can be stupid on the internet, you know, because that's the blunt way of putting it.
Yeah,
and
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Now, what is tonight's topic for Linux with that caveat out of the way, that reminder?
It is holiday gift giving, donating to open source projects.
I love this topic. You know, open source doesn't just apply to the Linux operating system either. I mean, if you look at the free software list at ComputerAmerica.com, there's a bunch of free software and free services for the Windows platform and the Mac platform and even the Linux platform, from OpenDNS, which works on any platform, to, you know, there are people that I don't want to give McAfee or Norton my money because, you know, they're a conspiracy theorist and they think that they're partially responsible for some of the viruses. And wouldn't you know it, we have the cure for the virus. Although that's never been proven. The idea that there's free antivirus then says, look, you don't have to spend the money if you're a conspiracy theorist, because a conspiracy theorist will say it's never been not been proven either. You know what I mean? It's just
right.
Because they haven't been caught is their attitude. Doesn't mean it's not happening. And I don't even know how to respond to that. I'm sure that Norton McAfee, you're not doing that. But to satisfy them in a way that's not argumentative is to say, look, there's these free open source antivirus products available for Windows. And I think, isn't there a free open source antivirus for Linux?
Sure, there are a number of antivirus software programs out there, and some from the big-name antivirus companies as well. And most of them are open source. Some of them are like AVG, which I'm not sure whether it's open source or not. I think it's kind of your freemium model where you have a free version that you give away, and then you try to get people to upgrade to the pro version by giving them some additional features or more frequent updates or things like that. And I know there was another company, another big-name antivirus company that came out with a version for Linux just recently. I can't remember off the top of my head who they were, but they operate the same way. But certainly in your list of free software, and I've taken a look through there, whether it's for Windows, Mac, or Linux, there are plenty of those free software providers that are open source. And they are either A, produced by somebody who needs the software themselves and it's essentially a work of love for them, or B, they are looking for donations or are funded by a foundation that runs on donations or some other way relies on the generosity of other people to keep them. Yeah, I was going to say in business. Well, I guess they are in the business of helping people, although it's not a profitable business for them. They are more or less nonprofit and are providing a service and rely on donations and funding to provide that service. And many Linux distributions fall into that category as well, and that's why we're talking about open source software in general on a Linux program.
What's great about open source is that the code is available for people to alter it or improve upon or continue the development of said project. So you say, for example, this guy wrote this program for Windows called Dial-A-Fix. Wonderful program that solves a lot of common problems. So then the guy gets sick of the industry and completely changes careers and abandons the project.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody has picked it up. And so that ends up happening with these one-man sort of projects. But when it's with a community like SourceForge, which is just a wonderful community of open source projects, just a cornucopia of all different types of software, from backup and partitioning to cloning to, gosh, defragmenters, everything, that no one single person necessarily handles it forever. It's generally somebody makes a decision, however it's decided, I don't know, that they're the one in charge, and then eventually they're typically replaced by somebody else who takes on the role. In fact, over at driverpacks.net, they went through this sort of thing with the folks there. And thankfully, other people are willing to take on the responsibility and continue the development of these projects. In the chat room, Inet Ken wants to know if you, Larry, could describe the difference between free software and open source software.
Yes. Well, there's a fairly big political battle over this, and there is a difference between free software and open source software. And in fact, there are two kinds of free software. There's free with a small f, which includes open source software, many kinds of open source software, and free with a small f represents free of charge. And so there are plenty of software programs out there, packages, even operating systems like Linux that are free of charge. Free with a capital F, on the other hand, is something that represents freedom. And the two ways that people describe those two versions of free, with a lowercase f, that's free as in fear, and with an uppercase F, that's free as in freedom. And what we mean by that is the Free Software Foundation has four freedoms that they endeavor to protect by ensuring that free software, with a capital F, it remains free. So they want to build on what we were just talking about, which is the ability to look at the source code of the product. That's one of the freedoms. To copy it and redistribute it, to make changes, and to use it in any way you want. And since we're up against a break, we'll continue this part after, or this part of the conversation after we come back.
All right. This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network, 866-606-TALK. It's all Linux tonight. We'll continue on with Larry right after this.
It's 35 minutes after the hour. We are live here with the Computer America Show on the Business and the Lifestyle Talk Radio Networks, broadcasting across the nation on radio stations from coast to coast and on computers and other internet-connected devices around the world through the web at our website, computeramerica.com. It's the third Tuesday of the month, just a couple days away from Christmas. This is our All Linux Show, as we do on every third Tuesday of the month, dedicating the topic of both hours of the show to the Linux operating system. If you're sick and tired of paying for Windows or frustrated with the crashes or all of the updates for keeping yourself safer, well, you still have a little bit of that with Linux, but nowhere near as much as you have to deal with Windows. And, you know, it's a whole other sense of freedom. Actually, you'd think a Mac user would be more appealing to the freedom of choice that you get with Linux, but and you don't necessarily have to make a choice of one or the other. You can actually have Linux as a live CD you can boot from, or install it as a virtual machine on your computer, and actually you don't, like I say, you don't have to sacrifice one for the other. You can have it all. And before the break, we were just talking about the difference between free software and open source software. And I think a lot of people get confused where they say, well, if it's free, how can this company take it, modify it, and then sell it? Well, that's perfectly legitimate. They're allowed to do that. They're allowed to take that and, for example, the software on your TiVo, or the software on your cable box, perhaps, or the software in your router, the software in your squeeze box, maybe, could be based on an open source Linux platform that they've modified and proprietarized, and maybe even, if I might be wrong here, but maybe even close the source on it and said it's ours now. Can they do that?
No, it depends on the license. Generally speaking, okay. No, they can't do that. But if it is, because if it's open source, license terms is that you need to essentially, you've heard of Creative Commons, and when you create something, you want to share alike. Well, it's very much like that with the licenses around free software, free with a capital F. And so we were talking about the differences between the two versions of free, lowercase f and uppercase F. And I've put a couple of links in the show notes to a couple of articles, one that's from Wikipedia on gratis versus Libre, gratis being free of charge, Libre being free as in freedom. And I've also included a link to an article that I posted to the Going Linux website called Define Free. And in that article, I talk about some of the differences between the various terms that are used and try to help remove the ambiguity between the various terms. There are terms like free or gratis or open source or Libre or closed source or proprietary or non-free, freeware, shareware. They all have slightly different meanings. And the original question was, what's the difference between free and open source? So we've described free as in beer and free as in freedom. But what open source is, the Free Software Foundation likes to think of, would like us to use the term non-free software.
Non-free?
Meaning it's not free as in freedom. In other words, there are potentially some license restrictions to it, or some sort of restriction that doesn't meet the requirements of the Software Foundation in order to qualify as a truly free, under their terminology, software program.
Well, let me ask you this. Is this really important for anybody to understand unless you're a developer? I mean, does it really matter that we know these semantic differences as a consumer of the software? Or is this really only applying to somebody who intends to distribute or manipulate it for their own project that they plan on selling or just redistributing? In other words, if I'm just a consumer, what difference does either of the free make to me other than trivia?
For the average consumer who's using software on a netbook, let's say, and they have some sort of version of Linux that allows them to boot instantaneously and get onto a website, and then if they want to go into the, quote, real operating system, they have to reboot into Windows, The differences are almost moot from a user perspective. Now, from the perspective of how do I use it day to day. So it really doesn't matter from a practical perspective. Now, if you are if you are a developer and you're distributing your software, you need to pay very close attention to which license you use, because that determines whether or not, A, you can make a profit on it, B, you can give it away if you choose to do so, and C, whether or not you have the rights to even do anything other than give it to the copyright holder or the license holder under which you wrote the program. So you could be giving away your rights to the program you wrote if you choose the wrong license. Now, right. For the average user, though, there is an important distinction here, and one is that when you use software that is commercial software, typically the motives of the company providing you that software are twofold. They want to make money, and they want to keep you as a customer. And one of the ways they keep you as a customer is try to lock you in. And one of the ways they try to lock you in is by not allowing you to use competitors' products. And so they write their code in such a way that if you are using a competitor's product, you're at a disadvantage than if you use a product from the same manufacturer. Let's take Microsoft, for example. So if you're using Microsoft Windows as your operating system, they want you to use Microsoft Office as your Office suite. And so they optimize Windows to run Microsoft Office. And there are a couple of documented issues with running OpenOffice on Windows that don't appear when you're running OpenOffice on a Mac and don't appear when you're running OpenOffice on Linux. Mm. And there's, I don't know whether it's conspiracy theory or whether it's a real issue, but the bottom line is that there are some things that Windows appears to do to make OpenOffice not run as well as the Microsoft Office platform. Really? Now, another way that they try to lock you in is, let's again take Microsoft as the biggest target we can shoot at here. If you want to use a mail program with Microsoft Windows, they want you to use a Microsoft product like Outlook. And so they try to make it so that Outlook will work best with Office and will integrate with Office and will work extremely well with the Windows operating system. And if you try to use an open source product like Thunderbird or even another commercial product like Lotus Notes for your email, some of the things that work extremely well as an integrated platform don't work so well with the competitive products. And it's not that they can't make it work, it's that they don't want it to work because they want you to use their products. Mm-hmm. And sure, some of the onus is on the other vendor to make it work as well, but because the software source code is proprietary and is not available for the other company to view, they simply can't make it work optimally with Microsoft Windows or another Microsoft product because they have no access to that source code. Now, in some cases, companies like Microsoft will allow you to purchase the rights to examine portions of their source code and allow you to work with them to develop optimization of your product to work with their product. But again, that costs money and that's transferred on to the consumer who buys that additional product, putting that competitor at a disadvantage again. Compare that with open source or even free software, Libre software, where you have the ability to look at the source code as a programmer, and you can see, if you're a programmer, how to make your program work optimally with the operating system or with something else, another program, for example.
Now, that said, I have installed OpenOffice for a couple of clients, one running a business, had Windows 7, was not happy with it, wanted to go back to XP, and I said, that's fine, I'll have to reinstall everything. I can't take it backwards. And they said, well, it's got Office on it. And I said, I can't transfer it. You need to give me the disk. I don't have the disk. And then go and find out that they have an enterprise version that they shouldn't have had because Enterprise is a large corporation. And they had a good friend that was taking care of, quote-unquote, taking care of them, which they weren't really doing them any favors because when the guy passed away, they were left not having any disks and weren't able to take care of things. And I said, well, let's just try OpenOffice. I asked them how, you know, after I put it on there, how it was working. They said they love it. So as far as they're concerned, they can't really see any difference as far as how it works and what they can do with it. So in spite of the fact you say it doesn't work as well, for many people it works well enough they can't tell the difference. It's 51 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to the Computer America Show, broadcasting live on radio stations across the country here on the Business and the Lifestyle Talk Radio Networks as we continue on with our All Linux Show, as we do every third Tuesday of the month, with Larry Bushy, host of the Going Linux podcast, a digital broadcast that you can listen to anytime at your convenience through the web at goinglinux.com. We'll have the links to Larry's podcast in our show notes after the show, as well as links to everything else that we're discussing during the show tonight for both hours. And, of course, we're taking your phone calls. If you have a Linux-related question, you're welcome to call us. It's toll-free, 866-606-TALK, 866-606-8255. I'll get you on and get you through. Or join us in our chat room at ComputerAmerica.com. And we're just talking about, we talked about the difference between free and free, with the lowercase f or an uppercase left, and open source software.
Right.
And
we were talking as well about why would a consumer care about the differences between the semantic definitions of those various words. And during the break, I was thinking about that. And one of the things that you get with free and open source software that you don't get with commercial software, for the most part, is the ability to try before you buy. Certainly most commercial software, you have to go to the store, rip open the package, and as soon as you rip open the package, you have agreed to the license terms, and many stores won't take the software back if you decide you don't like it afterwards.
Yeah, they'll only exchange it.
Yes. So you're out the money, whereas with open source software, whether it's a freemium model where they provide one version for free and another version paid, or whether it's simply funded by a foundation or by donations, as Linux would be in many cases, you get the ability to try the software, no obligation, no risk, and in most cases for no money. And if you go ahead and purchase the pro version before you try out the free version, well, you're out the money. But many of the developers will refund your money and be done with it because they don't want you upset with them. They don't want you saddled with software that you purchased in good faith and doesn't meet your requirements. One of the reasons people develop free software, open source software, is because they want it to be the best software for whatever the particular application is they're developing that software. And they want happy customers as well. They just don't go to the extreme of trying to lock you in, but with license terms and with intentional incompatibilities with competitors' products.
Now, with Linux now, it's not just the software that's open source, but the entire operating system.
Yes.
And in the chat room, they were mentioning that what Ubuntu, they said, isn't really a developer so much as a what's the word I'm looking for?
A provider. Sort of it's a distribution.
Yeah, or a repackager, maybe, is what you're
doing. Yeah,
yeah.
Something like that.
Sure. Well, you could make that argument for any distribution of Linux because every distribution of Linux, whether that's Red Hat, SUSE, Ubuntu, Fedora, any of them, they all build on the work of other people. There is a kernel that is the main part of the operating system that is curated by Linus Torvalds, and he is the main contributor to the kernel, and he curates the contributions from other people, and there are many, many other people that contribute to the kernel, but none of the distributions that use that kernel own that kernel. Some of them provide kernel developers who contribute to it, but they are all building on the original work of Linus Torvalds. And so from that perspective, you could say, yeah, they're just repackaging all Linus's work. But if you really think about it, that's what makes open source great, because you can build on the shoulders of giants. I've heard that term used in the open source community and a lot of other areas besides Linux. But it's a phrase that goes around a lot in the area of Linux, because that's exactly what you're doing. You're building on the work of others, and it's the great work of those other people that allow you to take the bits and pieces that you want and put them into a distribution of Linux the way you want to see it. And if other people want to use it, great. If you're the only one using it, no problem. You're free to do it that way as well.
And here's something important to remember. When you go to the store and you buy software or you buy Windows, you're voting. You're voting with your dollar.
Yes.
And if you want to vote to see more of the open source, if you want to encourage it, then you can do so at any point. But since it's the holiday gift-giving season, donating to these open source projects show your support and your vote for the continued development of future open source projects.
Right, and one other additional point on that is you don't have to donate money to these open source software developers. If you are in a job where it's not so high paying and you're having enough trouble making your own rent payments, you don't need to be contributing to an open your hard-earned cash to an open source project. You can contribute time. You can contribute something as simple as doing some documentation. Or even if you find a bug, just report it to them. That's a way of contributing that has a value far beyond your donation and extends into every other user of that open source software program.
You know, I'm glad you said that, and that really shows that the community isn't, again, it's not about necessarily the money. It's about being able to have the ability to offer the software to begin with, and it's not just the distribution, but the creation and the maintenance of that software.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And with the Financial Times being what they are, perhaps you're not going out to the movies or going out to dinner as often as you were, and you have to stay at home, and what a great way to educate yourself and add to your resume while at the same time helping an open source project or contributing as in ways that you mentioned.
Right.
You start writing documentation for an open source project, and you do that well enough, you could put that on a resume. Yeah, I'm a tech doc writer. You know,
exactly.
You never know, that could lead you into your next job.
Yeah. Listen, Larry, we've got questions in the chat room, and also we have emails that we're going to be reading in this second hour. So why don't all of you kind of just – we'll take a little break here after your local and national news, and then we'll continue on with Linux here tonight on the Computer America Show. 866-606-TALK. That's the toll-free number. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Computer America. Computers run the world, and we run computers.
Hello and welcome into hour two of the nation's longest-running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
I'm your co-host, Carrie Holzman.
And we continue on with our All Linux Show. It's the third Tuesday of the month. Larry Bushy, the creator and host of Going Linux podcast, continues on with us, and we're going to get into some questions and emails that he received. However, before we get to those, I just want to read a question that we had in the chat room that was for Larry. Mm-hmm. And this is from someone who calls himself Linus Freak. I think he meant Linux, L-I-N-U-X, but he has L-I-N-U-S. That could be Linus Torvald. No. Yeah?
Possibly. Yeah,
yeah, it could be. It could be, yeah, exactly. Or maybe he's a Peanuts fan.
You
know?
You never know.
But his question is, will Linux ever be a major player on the desktop for the general public? Why can't I get a basic laptop or desktop from Best Buy, Walmart, Office Depot, etc., running Linux?
Walmart tried.
Yeah, they did. And to answer the last question first, it's a matter of demand. The big box stores like Best Buy, the discount stores like Walmart, and various other retailers, they need to make money at what they do, and they're going to stock the most popular products regardless of how many Linux customers come in and say, I want a Linux computer. They're going to be a small portion of the overall volume of customers that they have. And it's the same argument that the individual privately owned hardware stores make against Walmart coming into their community. It's going to put them out of business, and time again we see them putting them out of business. The community-run hardware store, the privately owned hardware store, can have your favorite version of the hammer or your particularly favorite nails or whatever it is you're using because they know you. They're part of the community, you're part of the community, and you talk to the owner. Walmart comes in, and they're going to completely obliterate that small vendor, and they're going to replace whatever they were carrying with the most popular products out there because that's what makes them the money. What made the individual hardware store owner the money was the products that his individual customers wanted. Walmart, like it or not, doesn't care about the individual customer. They care about customers in general, and they're out there to supply the masses with the most popular products. So that's why they have iPads. That's why they have Dell computers and HP computers, because those are the ones they get the biggest demand for. Now, the other part of the question is, when can I get Linux on a laptop? Well, you can get Linux on a laptop. You just have to order it as a special order. And you can get them from Dell, although they keep making them harder and harder to find on the Dell website. But there are other companies out there like ZA Reason, like System 76, like Tux Machines, and like Jonathan Nadeau's company. He's co-guest that we had on, blind computer user, who sells computers with Linux on them and even optimizes some of them for blind users. And his business is doing this. So there are plenty of places to get Linux installed, not the least of which, if you're concerned about price, and many of these specialized vendors are a little higher priced, and you can get an HP laptop on sale for a really good price at Costco because they have a sale on it and it's the holiday season. You can buy that laptop and you can install Linux on it yourself because Linux is free.
There you go. Well, hopefully Linus Freak, you... Okay, and he says he heard it and he thanks you for your answer. There you go. All right, excellent. So let's go to some of these emails that you received here. And I guess we'll begin with the very first one. This is from someone called Rick, wrote to you with an observation about running Linux from a USB flash drive.
That's right. So Rick says, hi, Tom and Larry. Tom, just for those first-time listeners, is my co-host on the Going Linux podcast. Rick continues, I am listening to episode 119, and you were responding to a listener trying to set up a Linux desktop on a flash drive. You commented that long-term use of a flash drive may not be a good idea. I ran Linux Mint on a 4-gigabyte flash drive for nearly a year as I evaluated the operating system on my netbook. I never had a problem. I keep Linux Mint on a 2-gigabyte flash drive on my keyring for troubleshooting as I am out and about. My netbook does not have a hard drive, but internal solid-state drive, and I run two SD cards for storage. Linux Mint 9 is now the only operating system on the netbook. Keep doing what you do. I enjoy listening to your podcasts. Rick. And this was actually in response to a comment that I had made that if you are using a flash drive to as your main drive for running Linux on a computer, and you can do that with Linux. You can install it on a flash drive and just boot your computer from the flash drive. If you are using that flash drive to store data and use it frequently to read and write data, it depending on the quality of the flash drive, you may wear it out very quickly. Many of the inexpensive flash drives are not super high quality and aren't designed for continuous use in the way that you would use it as a main hard drive, if you will, for a computer. So in Rick's experience, he hasn't found that to be a problem, but he also says he uses it for troubleshooting. So I'm assuming he's not using it for day-to-day use. So just a word to the wise that don't depend on a flash drive to always be there for you. It might just one day no longer function.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that before we move on? Go ahead.
In my mind, this is just a matter of whether or not you will be willing to rely on the reliability of a flash drive as your main hard drive for your computer.
Okay.
If you're okay with that, or if it completely goes blank on you one day, you don't care about it, that's fine. But I wouldn't do it that way.
Is there any reason why I should be worried about it? I mean, flash drives are extremely reliable.
Well, they are. However, they're not made for continuous use. Continuous reading and writing and so on. And in most cases, the flash drive is, as you can see from his email, a 2 gigabyte or maybe a 4 gigabyte flash drive that many people carry around on their keychains. That's not a lot of drive space. And if you're using the same drive space over and over again, even with a hard drive, a 20, 60, 80, 120, 500 gig hard drive, there are only so many reads and writes you can make to that. Now, with 500 gigabytes worth of space, you've got a lot more room to generate some errors and have it be forgiving. With 2 gigabytes worth of space, you've only got so many reads and writes before it gives up the ghost and leaves you high and dry, if I'm not mixing metaphors there.
You're entitled to mix your metaphors. All right. We're getting close to the break, but I guess we can start on the next one. This is from John.
From John.
Yes.
Yeah, John is a frequent listener to the podcast, and I believe he also listens to Computer America Live from time to time. And he writes in, "Hi, Larry and Tom. Love your show. Look forward to the new episodes each month. I have an interesting dilemma. What's new?" And John does seem to get himself into interesting dilemmas. "I seem to have several," he says. "I have my new Win7 64-bit system. It's okay, but I do want to continue to use my old Dell Dimension 4550 with XP and a good working Ubuntu 10.04. I've been using a good ISO on a DVD of 64-bit Ubuntu, and it runs okay, but not the same as though it's installed." So what he's saying there is he's running Ubuntu 64-bit from the live DVD as opposed to actually installing it. "I've looked at several options. Which is best, running two computers with one monitor? That's the question. I'm sure you guys have similar situations. I've tried KVM switches, iOmega. Two port didn't work, wouldn't allow XP to connect, and we're about halfway through John's email, so we'll leave the rest of it until when we come back after the break."
Okay, this is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network, 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number, live at computeramerica.com, the email address, or, of course, our chat room at computeramerica.com. We'll continue on with Larry right after this. With with us right now, of course, Larry Bushy, and we were right in the middle of reading the email from John in Dallas. So did you want to continue on that? Okay, continue on.
Sure. And John had already told us that he has a couple of computers, an older one with XP and Ubuntu installed, I'm assuming he's dual booting, and a Windows 7 system, a newer system, and he's trying to get them so that he can use them from the same monitor and the same mouse, I'm assuming, as well. And he says he's tried KVM switches and a product from iOmega called 2-Port, and that wouldn't work with XP, apparently, or at least he couldn't get it working. Continuing with the last half of his email, he writes, I'm looking at this product, and he provides us a link to a product called Synergy. And I'll have a little bit more to talk about Synergy, to say about Synergy in a moment. And he says, this is software-based. It's a software-based solution. It looks very difficult to set up and is for multiple monitors. I've tried Kavoom and provides us a link to that website as well. It didn't work either. I couldn't get XP recognized. And I took a look at the Kavoom website, and it indeed is a KVM solution as well. I hope you guys can direct me in the right path from your experiences. Since the Windows 7 is SATA, I can't use my old IDE drives in it. Darn it. I thought Dell, all manufacturers, would include an IDE connector on the motherboard, but they say they don't.
Nowadays? Are you kidding me?
Exactly.
Where's my MFM and RLL drive connector?
Yeah, and how do you convert a VHS tape to CD?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are adapters you can buy.
IDE, but they don't come on the CD.
No, but you can go to Newegg and Newegg.com, and for $10, $15, you buy the adapter and then your hard drive will connect. Or you can
You can put an IDE drive in a case and plug it into USB and make it work.
Or you can buy an IDE PCI controller card and slap it in there, too, for that matter.
So we've solved all of the problems that John didn't ask. Let's talk about the problem that he didn't ask.
Well, if you're going to be picky.
Well, we're trying to help everyone, aren't we? So John is looking, quite frankly, for a way to make two computers work from a single location so that he doesn't have to go between computer to computer, so that you can sit in one spot, use one keyboard, and control both computers. Now, I have posted in the show notes a couple of links to some solutions here. One of them is I've only posted one of them because the other one is linked from the first one. So I've posted a link to an article that I wrote on connecting Synergy. And that is what I would recommend, John, that you use. Synergy in about 2007 was very difficult to set up, both on Windows and on Linux. And just for those of us who aren't familiar with Synergy, it's a program that allows you to connect two computers, whether it's Windows or Linux. I'm not sure they have a version for Mac, but allows you to do just what John wants to do, which is to control two computers from a single keyboard and mouse. And it's not through sharing of the screen. It's through connecting your keyboard and mouse through the software to the two different computers. So you use one computer as essentially a server and the other one as a client, if you're a techie sort of person like me. In 2007, Matt Cutts wrote an article that I linked to from my article, and it describes it's a very popular article on how to configure Synergy in six easy steps. And since it was written in 2007, he wrote it from the perspective of somebody using software in 2007, and he was writing it from the perspective that I have a Windows computer and I want to install Synergy on there and on an Ubuntu, early version Ubuntu, and I want to get these two computers working from a keyboard and mouse. He describes how to do that, and it is pretty complex. Fast forward to 2010 and take a look at my article. And in my article, what I describe is a couple of additional steps when you just count steps. But really, what has happened in those intervening years is the open source community, which Synergy is part of, has developed Quick Synergy to go along with Synergy, the original program. And what Quick Synergy allows you to do on Linux is to configure Synergy very, very easily in a nice little three-tab box that allows you to, from the computer running Synergy and with the mouse and the keyboard connected to it, you can actually connect, you can actually control up to four other computers. And so from your main computer's screen, you would configure perhaps a computer to the left and another computer to the right, and you would drag your mouse past the left edge of the screen, and it would go to the screen on the other computer that you've set up to the left of that computer, and now you're controlling that computer. Anything you type, any mouse movements are on that computer. Drag your mouse back through the computer, your main computer, drag it off to the right, past the right edge of your screen, and now it goes over onto the screen of the computer to the right of your main computer. And now anything you type and any mouse click you make are actually controlling that computer. Well, how do you get two more? Because I said you can have four. Well, there are four sides to your monitor. You can configure another computer above your main screen and below your main screen. Now, you don't actually have to position the computers there. You don't have to put one on top of the other. But that's where you move your mouse to go to the other screen. And it's really a fantastic program, and I use it all the time. It works with Linux and Windows. And read the article if you're interested in how to set it up.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take another break, and then we'll continue on with lots more. This is the Computer America Show. Larry Bushy, creator of the Going Linux podcast, continues on with us. It's all Linux tonight. We'll continue on with them right after this.
Thirty-five minutes after the hour, as we continue on with the Computer America Show, broadcast live, coast-to-coast on the business and lifestyle talk radio networks, and across the world through the web at ComputerAmerica.com. It's all Linux for both hours. This show, it's the third Tuesday of the month, and we do that every third Tuesday of the month with our guest, Larry Bushy, the host of the Going Linux podcast, which is a free audio on demand you can listen to through your computer, or you can download it and put it on an MP3 player, run it to a CD, listen to it in your car to learn more about the Linux operating system. It's what's wonderful about that. You ever have to call somebody for support, and you end up getting that guy in another country with the accent you can't understand, and you ultimately figure out you're smarter than he is? But with Linux, when you need support, it's a community-driven support system for the most part, and there are paid versions of Linux, and the paid versions are paid because of the support that they offer. But I think the majority of Linux users do so, especially residential Linux users for sure, take advantage of the community support, and the Going Linux podcast is just one very small example of the type of support that's available. And in fact, during the show now, in the second hour, we're addressing some of your Linux questions sent on to Going Linux podcast and Larry. Because generally when somebody asks a question, in most cases, there's probably 100 other people at least with the same exact question who just didn't bother asking. So the idea is that, and because the podcast is made available for years after it's recorded, it may not be a problem you have yet, but we'll have one day. So it's always there. And, Where are we at, Larry? With the, did we finish that other email?
Yes, we did. And I have to make a comment, Kerry. Have you thought of getting into radio? You did a really great commercial for the Going Linux podcast.
Did I?
Well, yeah, you really did. And I wish we were recording this. Oh, wait a minute.
Speak,
we are.
I speak only. Listen, if you're a regular listener of the Computer America Show, I tell it like it is. I speak the truth. I call it as I see it. Sometimes it's not politically correct. And sometimes, you know, I get a little trouble over that, but I don't care because it's the way I see it. And, you know, we're not, Larry's not paid to be here, and Larry isn't paying us to be here. Everybody's here because we want to be here, and we want to share our knowledge and share our information. And I want to Certainly give you guys props for doing the job that you do. And what I really like about you, Larry, is you're not, is, for lack of a better term, brainwashed as many of the other Linux folks we've had on in the past who just refuse to see any other way.
Yeah.
They just think it's flawless, it's perfect, and Windows sucks, and that's all there is to it. But you have a more diplomatic and more unbiased view of what I consider to be the reality, and there are pros and cons no matter what you choose. Even a Mac, you know, there's pros and cons to Mac. There's pros and cons to Windows, and there's pros and cons to Linux. And I always like how when I ask a question that's critical of Linux, you don't immediately get offended.
Well, thanks.
More often than not, the people that we get or that we've had in the past immediately get offended, as if I just told them their mother was, you know, something.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's not my intention. As a journalist, my intention is to ask those riveting questions that people want to know or that people may encounter. If we're going to tell them you should try this operating system, I think we owe them the responsibility of saying you could encounter this. But the important thing is if you encounter it, there's a solution.
Yeah, and as we say on the show quite often, it's not for everybody. And if you try it and it is for you, great. You just save yourself a bunch of money, and you've got a great community behind you for support. And you've got radio shows like Computer America that see the benefit of talking about Linux. And you've got podcasts like Going Linux, and we're certainly not the only Linux podcast out there, where you can ask questions of the hosts and get them answered, not quite in real time when it's a podcast, but we do answer them, and we are responsive, and we try not to miss them. Every once in a while, we do miss talking about one of these emails on the air, and we hear about it.
But in all fairness, there are companies that you could pay for a product and not get an answer in real time, for that matter.
Well,
and have the answer be nowhere near as clear, as concise, or as accurate as the answers that you guys provide over at Going Linux or that you provide here at Computer America. So for that, we really appreciate you. Well, what the heck? I mean, we're here at the end of the year. This is the last show of the year for Linux for you to be with us. And just take a moment to say how much we appreciate you here at Computer
America.
And we're looking forward to continuing on as we have been in 2011 and continuing to expand on the Linux topic and the questions that are asked. And while it may not be for everybody, it may be for more people today than it was
before
this time last year, right? And this time next year, it'll be for even more people as more and more people adopt computers and more people become aware of it first and foremost. And then you have to get past their anxiety or fear, intimidation, to get them to try it, which is what we do here. And then after they've tried it and they have a problem, again, another part that we do here is to address those questions. But because Larry's on with us only once a month, in between, don't feel like you're cheating on us to go listen to Larry's podcast. By all means, go check it out. It's wonderful. And he covers much more in-depth Linux information because he doesn't have me interrupting him, eating up all the airtime. So please continue.
No problem at all. And I have to say thanks for having me on here. This is my 33rd appearance on Computer America. We've been doing this for a while, and I have and I have enjoyed every appearance I've had. So enough with
mutual
backslapping here. Let's move on to the emails.
All right.
Okay, we have another email. From Gene, yes. Gene says, Tom and Larry, I listened to, well, let me set this up first, okay? Gene is going to be talking about something in Linux that you just don't have with Windows, and that is the option to use a different desktop environment without changing your operating system. So if you're using Fedora, or if you're using Ubuntu, or if you're using Red Hat, or OpenSUSE, or any of the distributions of Linux, you're not limited to seeing your desktop just one way. And you don't have to go through a lot of configuration and moving things around and changing settings to get a whole different view of things. You just change the desktop environment. So he's going to be talking about GNOME, one desktop environment, Fluxbox, and various others. So having set that up, I also want to mention that he's going to mention Tom's nightmare in trying to go to a desktop environment called E16, Enlightenment 16. So with that set up, let's read Gene's email. He says, I listened to your Going Linux episode 122 listener feedback show today. I must say I am not a fan of Ubuntu or of GNOME, one of those desktop environments I just mentioned. I am a Fluxbox fanatic. That said, I will say there are better ways to try other, quote, desktop software than Tom's E16 nightmare. And just as background, Tom installed this desktop environment and was unable to use his computer afterwards and had to fight to get, actually had to reinstall the software, the operating system, to get it working again.
Ouch.
Tom has a tendency to do things like that. I have to say that just right up front. He's a little adventurous that way. He's a tinkerer and gets himself in trouble. Continuing with Gene's email, he says, I use two methods and both work fine under Mandriva Linux. And here he's talking about two methods to try other desktop software. The first method he mentions is create a Linux virtual machine with VirtualBox. Make a backup copy of the virtual disk and then try new stuff in the original. If stuff breaks, close the virtual machine, then copy the backup virtual disk over to your original virtual disk. This resets the virtual machine to a working copy, and you can do this as many times as you need. The second method is create another user on your existing system to try new desktops other than GNOME. Use the new desktop, such as Enlightenment 16, with that user. This user can be reset by removing the user, deleting the user's home directory, and then adding the user back again. So two different methods of approaching the same problem, and either one would have kept Tom out of hot water. Gene continues, however, Tom said something about Epiphany, the GNOME web browser, around 29 minutes and 54 seconds into the podcast. Then it sounds like Tom tried an E16 GNOME, Enlightenment 16 for GNOME, desktop hybrid installation, where E16 is supposed to replace the default window manager in GNOME. That is probably what broke his desktop. This is an educated guess, as I do not have Ubuntu to check this here. For your information, the latest release of Enlightenment is E17, and I recommend trying E17 as a standalone desktop. Avoid anything that looks like it replaces the window manager in GNOME. Since I don't use Ubuntu, you will have to figure out how to do this last part yourselves. And for the non-techie folks in our listening audience, I hope we didn't lose you there. That's pretty geeky.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, hey, sometimes you just have to go there.
Yep.
If not, we're coming back and we'll continue on. This is the Computer America Show. Linux is the subject matter for tonight's show. 866-606-TALK is the toll-free number. We'll continue on with Paul's email to us right after this. This is Computer America. Anyway, we got Larry Bushy here with us, and we're reading the emails. Did we finish the one with Gene? Yes, we did.
We did.
Yes, okay. So let's read Paul's email. Or you have Peter, Paul, and I was going to say Mary, but with
Todd. Yeah.
Todd, yeah, exactly. Which one do you think is for the final one? Which would you like to read?
Well, you know, the one that's probably the most interesting is Todd. So let's just skip to that.
Okay.
He writes an email that says, Linux at 34,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Larry and Tom. I was in my seat early today for a flight from Atlanta to Seattle in the U.S. Seats in this Boeing 757-200 are equipped with video screens in the seat backs. The crew booted the system while I was sitting there, and what do you know? Linux. At least part of this Boeing runs on Linux. Of course, Boeing may not have anything to do with the seatback video system, but you might think a plane from Boeing, Seattle, runs the risk of being wed to Windows, Redmond. But no, I feel better about Boeing and Delta. Also, free Wi-Fi on this flight. From my Android device at 34,000 feet, Todd. And of course, Android is one of those up-and-coming Linux platforms.
So there you go. All right. So so they're using Linux at least to show the videos.
Right, exactly. And many of the newer planes or planes where they have replaced the video system, those systems do run Linux, and if they do happen to boot them while you're sitting in the seat, you'll see a Linux screen, and oftentimes you can identify it because the version of Linux they use has a little penguin that appears on the screen as it's booting. So that's probably what Todd saw, and I've seen it myself on those seatback screens. I don't know whether it's just Boeing, but they seem to be the ones that are providing the most recent planes, at least for Delta and some of the airlines that I fly. So, very interesting.
Yes, it is. And I wonder if any of the navigation is Linux, too. But I guess I'll just
I don't know.
Well, listen, Larry, it's we're getting toward the end here. I just want to take a moment again to thank you so much for the time that you've spent with us and talking
Always
about Linux.
Always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure. I know you had to go to work tonight because of internet connection at home wasn't operating, so you took the time to went out there, and I really appreciate you. You couldn't go in the chat room. They got some sort of block on the chat. Who knows?
Yeah, our network folks have decided that chat is a security risk. Oh,
evidently. Maybe you can have words with them and they will make exceptions for next time. But listen,
I doubt it.
But I want to thank you again for being with us here tonight. And again, of course, it's the Going Linux podcast. We have a link to it at computeramerica.com. And it's also on our links page at computeramerica.com. Larry, thanks so much for being with us here, and we'll catch you next year. So happy New Year to you, okay?
Happy New Year, happy holidays, and see you in the new year.
You got it. Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Larry.
Well, so that wraps it up. So until tomorrow night, this is Craig Crossman hoping that your hard disk never becomes floppy. We will see you tomorrow night.
Good night, everybody.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.